Good evening. My name is Dennis Muller. I'm the Acting Director of the Centre for Advanced Journalism here at Melbourne University, and I welcome you all on a night that one of our distinguished guests assures me it would be a balmy summer's evening in Reykjavik. We're privileged to welcome Kristin Throbson, a distinguished investigative journalist from Iceland who's become the public face of WikiLeaks while Julian Assange is constrained in England, and John Kane, who is a reformist premier of Victoria from 1982 to 1990 and father of freedom of information legislation in Australia. So we have for tonight's discussion two particularly qualified individuals to talk about this topic, both from a perspective of the journalist and from that of government. Kristin will speak first, followed by John, and then there will be opportunity for questions from the floor. I would ask you, when you're asking questions, to formulate your contribution in the form of a question rather than a speech. So, thank you. Please welcome me in joining in welcoming Kristin Throbson.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for inviting me here today. You're absolutely right. This is extremely nice weather for me, and feel much at home. And adding to that, you have an ash cloud in the sky disrupting air travel. So it couldn't be more like my home country, actually. Special welcome to the tweeters and bloggers in the audience. We at WikiLeaks, we really think highly of this new form of journalism. I will speak about WikiLeaks here tonight and the most recent and high-profile projects about our relations with the media, and some thoughts about the possible impact the organization has had on journalism. But let me begin with a few words on secrecy. A few days ago, the story broke that some hackers had broken into the computers of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and gotten access to some unspecified data. Most news stories I've seen on this are similar. They outline the gravity of the incident. Some reports have claimed that the data might be politically explosive. And in this report, in the English Independent, it is claimed that the IMF had become, quote, the latest and potentially the most serious victim of attack by computer hackers. The Independent claims that this grave incident has caused concerns that sensitive information about the finances of government and governments might have fallen into the wrong hands. And when I read this, I thought, hang on, what can possibly be sensitive about finances of government? What can possibly be sensitive about macroeconomic data pertaining to a state? What possible harm can be caused if this information is, well, for example, available to everybody? We all know that the IMF is only called in when governments need a bailout. The IMF implements programs of austerity measures, privatizations, selling of state assets, tax hikes, cuts in spending, etc. So when the IMF is called in, everyone knows that the country is in deep trouble. And that's not a secret. So how on earth can information on the extent of the trouble and measures taken to counter the trouble be a secret? My own country, Iceland, was in such a terrible trouble after a near economic meltdown in the fall of 2008 that the government had to ask the IMF for help. And this was very controversial in Iceland, as in many other countries. And to tell you the truth, I don't see whatever in the relations between the IMF and the Icelandic government needs to be a secret. And I, as a citizen and taxpayer in Iceland, need to have a full account of all the information, correspondence, and measures taken by my government and the IMF. Nothing in the relations between these entities is in the none of my business category. And in my opinion, the same applies to the citizens of Greece and in all other countries that have dealings with the IMF. It is their fundamental democratic right. In one news story, I read that one reason for this supposed seriousness of this incident was that sensitive correspondence between IMF staff and state leaders could be very damaging if it leaked. And I thought, what on earth could be damaging there? Would it be an email from the Prime Minister of Greece to former IMF leader Dominik Strauss-Kahn? And how would that read? You know, thank you for your last visit. We were happy to have you here. Hope you enjoyed the hospitality of our hotel staff. No, I mean, it's a tasteless joke, I know. But you know, let's be serious. There is nothing there. And to give you, to qualify it a little bit, I've seen quite a few articles on this story, and I'm amazed that I've not seen a single one that critically asks the fundamental question, why the need for secrecy? And even the left-wing Independent fails to ask this question. And, well, there is possibly something there that is so sensitive that it shouldn't be out. I can't imagine anything, but it should be asked. It should be the task of journalists to ask that critical question. And the IMF and the government, they should have to state the reason for the secrecy. And the reason for this is probably the fact that we have been so accustomed to the norm of secrecy, secrecy in governments and secrecy by other holders of powers, big international corporations that are more powerful than many states, that secrecy has become the norm instead of being a rare exception. And this secrecy trend has escalated in recent times, all under the assumption, of course, that this is totally necessary for us, the citizens, to be kept ignorant, necessary for our security. But we at WikiLeaks disagree. We believe it is a fundamental in a democratic society that citizens have access to all relevant information they need to make and they need to have to be able to make an informed decision. If we, the people, do not have this access, democracy is fundamentally flawed. And we know that power is abused. And the more secrets we have, the greater the danger of abuse. A few words about WikiLeaks. It's an organization founded by yours truly, Julian Assange, in 2006. And before the turbulent chapter in its history that started about 14 months ago, WikiLeaks had published information from many countries, often uncovering corruption. There was material pertaining to the Kenyan government, the Church of Scientology, the failed Icelandic banks, the Bank of Julius Baer, toxic waste dumping in the Ivory Coast, and the list goes on. Despite the importance of this information, WikiLeaks and its revelations went relatively unnoticed. This, of course, changed when we started publishing material pertaining to the US military and State Department. And then, subsequently, WikiLeaks was criticized for being anti-American and overly focused on the United States. But nothing is further from the truth. WikiLeaks does not pick targets. It's a passive recipient of material that whistleblowers can submit securely and anonymously, just like any other media outlet, such as newspapers. Today, we have between 15 and 20 people on the payroll. I don't have the accurate number, as some are working on a short-term basis and others on a long-term contract, so this varies from time to time. So this is a relatively small organization. Much has been said about the supposed lack of transparency, and critics point to the fact that people who work for the organizations are not known. A few of us who work for WikiLeaks are known, but it is true that the identity of most is protected. It would probably be different if we were working in a different climate. In light of the current attacks, we consider it essential to protect our people. And if you think about the heated words that have been uttered, where prominent figures such as have even called for the assassination of the core staff, including Julian Assange, I believe we are justified in this approach. And even Sarah Palin, who could well become the next president of the United States, God help us, said that Julian should be hunted like Osama bin Laden. And we all know now what that means. But in addition to the core group of staff, we have volunteers that contribute, some almost full-time, to the organization, and very many can be called in to help part-time when needed. And yes, critics have said that a lot about the supposed murkiness of our finances. A lot of reports have been about that. But they haven't bothered to visit the website of the Vau Holland Foundation in Germany. It's a German charity that handled most of our finances, our donations, and our expenditures last year. And on their website, you can find rather detailed information about our finances in 2010, including donations and reimbursements of cost. A few legal entities have been established in various countries, for example, Iceland, that have taken part in the WikiLeaks project, or hopefully will be in the future. WikiLeaks is a publisher, often described as the publisher of last resort. Some claim it is impossible to keep the organization accountable, and that is not entirely correct. WikiLeaks has in the past had to face legal challenges and have always won. We hear criticism that we do not abide by any code of ethics. Well, I do, as a journalist and a member of the Icelandic Federation of Journalists. Julian is also a member of Australia's Journalist Association and is probably bound by the code of ethics there. Also, WikiLeaks has set the standards of harm minimization in releasing information, and it is, in my opinion, in line with what most media organizations abide by, or at least claim to abide by. So I think it is fair to say also that most of us at WikiLeaks adhere to the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The last year has been turbulent in the history of WikiLeaks. It started with the release of a secret military video on April 5th last year. It was released under the title Collateral Murder and showed, among others, the killing of innocent civilians on July 12, 2007 in the Al-Amin Thania neighborhood in southeastern Baghdad. In my opinion, exposing this video was of historic significance, and it has become a symbol of the war we never got to see in Iraq. It shows the real meaning of the term collateral damage. Two Reuters employees were killed in the attack, and the news organization was shown part of this video, and Reuters had been trying to get access to it ever since, and requested it under the US Freedom of Information Act. The Pentagon has stalled for years and obviously never intended to release it. The video is graphic and horrifying to watch, and it is not uncommon to find first-time viewers with tears in their eyes or momentarily shell-shocked at the confronting footage. WikiLeaks sent me as a journalist to Baghdad to gather additional information on the ground before the release of the video. And in a hasty trip, I managed to meet the families of those killed and the two young children, Said and Doa, who were the only ones surviving the attack. Their father, Matashir Tomal, was killed in the attack, and his only crime was to stop to try to help a wounded Reuters employee, Said Shma. We offered this material, the interviews and photographs, free of charge to any media who wanted it. And I have to admit, I was quite surprised how little interest there was in the full story, in the human angle of those who testified about their loss and suffering because of this incident. Apart from a few Western TV stations who carried small part of this material and a couple of newspapers who used the photos, the story focused on the leak itself, not necessarily the story it told. And then instantly there was this massive focus on Julian's persona. This was a revealing experience about the focus of the media, and I asked myself if we had gotten accustomed to completely block out the human angle to the war, at least the Iraqi human angle, had we journalists become so complicit in the strategy of dehumanizing the Iraqis and possibly see all of them as insurgents, as the enemy. And it made me think of how appallingly bad most Western journalists had been in reporting the Iraqi invasion and the war. And of course, this has to be seen in the context of the brilliant strategy of Pentagon of embedding journalism. Those who were not embedded were almost considered legitimate targets and maybe deliberate targets. A few days ago, I was in Spain talking to the relatives of Jose Coso, a cameraman who was killed in April 2003. He was standing on the balconies of the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad, where hundreds of journalists were staying, and everyone knew this was their place. When a crew of an Abrahams tank took aim and shelled the 14th floor, killing Jose and a Ukrainian cameraman. The family of Koso are still fighting for justice. Jose's brother told me they had produced a witness, a former U.S. serviceman, who had overheard radio communication of the plan to attack the Palestine. He intervened and urgently warned all parties, but it was deliberately ignored. And this is just one of many devastating attacks by Western forces on journalists in Iraq, the deadliest war in recent history for journalists. And this is possibly one reason very few journalists in Iraq go outside secure compounds and actually cover the story of the Iraqi people and their plight. The experience of the collateral murder release prompted us to rethink media strategy. It seemed that the best way of getting good analysis of our material was to make alliances with the established media and promise them some level of exclusivity. And so we did in the next release that caused quite a stir, the so-called Afghan War Diary, the release of over 90,000 incident and intelligence reports from the Afghan war. The release was in cooperation with three media partners, The Guardian, The New York Times, and the German weekly Der Spiegel. 15,000 of the logs were withheld in order to protect individuals who could be identified. And this is quite often overlooked. This was the biggest leak in military history of the United States to that date. It gave a detailed picture of the war from 2003 to 2010. It revealed also the kill and capture unit of special forces who were hunting and killing Taliban leaders without trial, how the use of drones was increasing, how the opposition in Afghanistan was escalating the resistance with roadside bombs, previously unreported civilian deaths. In short, it showed how the military venture in Afghanistan had been going from bad to worse over the years. The invasion was a response for the 9/11 attack, where more than 2,900 people were killed. But to date, more than 2,500 foreign troops have been killed in Afghanistan, and more than 30,000 civilians. The Afghan War Diary told a terrible story that we had not before had a first-hand evidence of, the story of a failed mission. And just like the Soviets experienced before, there seems to be no victory to be had in this battered land. This was an unwinnable war. I'm not an expert on Afghanistan, but I have to, I've been there twice, and one element that I always feel is missing in reporting from the country is the escalation of the poppy growth and heroin production. 95% of heroin sold on Western streets originates from Afghanistan. And according to UN agencies, 10,000 people die every year of an heroin overdose in Western cities. That's three times more than died on September 11th. And with that in mind, I've always thought it's almost surreal to see photos of Western troops wading through the poppy fields trying to find the enemy in hiding. And keep in mind as well that at least some of the proceeds of the drug trade is financing the insurgents. All went pretty well in the cooperation with the media partners last summer. The timidity of the New York Times came as a surprise. It was obvious that they were genuinely uncomfortable with putting themselves in opposition to the government by publishing this material. And for one who had always thought that the New York Times was a powerhouse of journalism, this was a great disappointment. And this was not the New York Times that took on the Nixon administration in the early 70s when the paper started publishing the Pentagon Papers from Daniel Ellsberg almost 40 years ago. I'm still not sure whether the paper was primarily afraid of repercussions or whether they simply did not want to upset a cozy relationship with Washington, and maybe it was a combination of both. The New York Times did, for example, not want to be first to publish the material online, which is rather odd as media organizations usually fight for the scoop. So we at WikiLeaks were delayed a little bit by a technical problem, and this caused great tension with the New York Times. They had the finger on the go button, but waited anxiously for WikiLeaks to publish first. WikiLeaks' approach was to use these established media houses to get the message out, to get access to the dozens of quality journalists to analyze the vast material and mine stories out of it. We consider this a cooperation on a basis of equality. It was agreed that WikiLeaks had a great say in the strategy of the release, as the organization was obviously going to take the heat for the publication. It slowly became apparent that The Guardian and The New York Times saw things differently. For Bill Keller, the editor of The New York Times, and David Lee at The Guardian, WikiLeaks was primarily a source. What was disturbing, though, is that those guys did not feel the same obligations toward this source as one is ethically supposed to do as a journalist, in my opinion. And this became apparent in September last year, prior to the release of the Iraq Warlocks. At that point, we wanted to expand the media exposure and get broadcasters on board. Originally, that was met with opposition, as the three print media thought they had agreed to full exclusivity. And Julian had to remind them that the exclusivity had been limited to print. We got the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in London on board as a producer of television programs for Al Jazeera and Channel 4 in the UK. The Swedish National Television also made their own program but worked in close proximity to the Bureau. At a later stage, the French daily Le Monde came on board and also El País in Spain. And thus was created a media cooperation on a scale never tried before. So this was a historic leak, but it was also a new chapter in media history. Never before had as many different news organizations cooperated on a single investigative project, and it was not without problems. There was great mistrust, fear that someone would break rank and go early, and there was also a great reluctance to share findings and research, as had been the original idea and demanded by us. The Germans at Der Spiegel were throughout very professional and stuck to the cooperative spirit. They shared great news stories that had been missed by others. In late August, early September, it became obvious to us that we needed to postpone the release of the Iraq logs, originally planned for in mid-September. The primary reason was that we were working on a complicated method of redacting sensitive material out of the logs. The approach was rather unique, as it entailed defining on the outset that all the information in the vast material would be considered harmful until proven otherwise. The approach was to reinstate harmless words step by step. And this was a complicated approach that took quite a time. David Lee at The Guardian had, for reasons of simplicity, been given the role of an intermediator with The New York Times and Der Spiegel. David was against the delay and played a rather silly political game in trying to stop it. All of this is, of course, not mentioned in his book about the project. There was even a threat to publish the stories without us being able to publish the material it was based upon at the same time, something very much against our principles. Lee was not at all concerned at this time about the interests of his media partner, WikiLeaks, or if he was to choose to look at WikiLeaks as primarily a source. He did not even see any objection to compromising the source if it suited his interest, and even tried to play a game of poker by trying to convince me. It was actually The New York Times and Der Spiegel who did not want to delay. Bluff that was called by simply contacting directly Bill Keller, The New York Times editor and the editor of Der Spiegel. We later found out that The New York Times had been in much closer contact to the administration than we thought was normal. This was not the kind of story that, where you need necessarily to give a right of reply. What was there to reply to? This was the publication of material pertaining from the Defense Department, the facts of the Iraqi war as seen by the US military. And the news headlines were quite extraordinary. The media partners had, of course, full editorial independence, and the flavor of their reporting was different. But it was interesting, though, that all focused on the story that the Americans were fully aware that the al-Maliki government was torturing detainees. And they did nothing to stop this, and even handed detainees over for torture. I say that all focused on this angle, with one notable exception. The New York Times decided to focus on Iranian involvement in Iraq. Well, overall, this was quite a sensational release and a new chapter in media history, as well as I previously mentioned. Keeping the media alliance together was quite a task. I don't know if you have the saying, but we have the saying in Iceland that sometimes when you have difficulty keeping people together, and it's like herding cats. And that was the experience with the media, totally unaccustomed to work together. And everyone wanted to go his own way, not accustomed to work in an alliance. There was a great surprise the day after the first release when the New York Times decided to publish on its front page a profile of Julian, a profile that can only be described as a sleazy hit piece. Of course, the New York Times was in full right to do a critical report on Julian, but it was very negative and one-sided, and giving the unusual prominence of the front page. And I say one-sided as the author, David Burns, the London bureau chief, did not get any input from those working closely with Julian, me included. Instead, he sought out the people who would obviously give negative comments. And later, Mr. Brisbane, the paper's public editor, defended the profile and admitted that it was a way of inoculating, as he put it, the paper from government criticism. And I leave it to you to judge how honorable that is to attack the person who has given you access to sensational material in this manner. And later, David Lee at The Guardian did the same thing in his book, and in public venues he has called him names. He has called him crazy, crazier day by day, called Julian narcissistic, deranged, and my favorite, a dirty, flaky hacker from Melbourne. I think I should be rather happy that I was referred to by David as a relatively sane Icelandic journalist. Anyway, of all the big leaks published by WikiLeaks in the last 14 months, surely the one with the greatest impact is the release of the State Department cables pertaining from the US embassies and consulates all over the world. There are 250,000 of them, and we call this the CableGate project. It started in late November last year. The release and the media collaboration has been in two steps. First, there was the first release by primary media partners, most of whom I mentioned. And later, we have been building an alliance with media in various countries where they get access to cables pertaining to their region. And in some countries, we've have made agreements with more than one news organization. And in other countries, the media environment is so untrustworthy that we have had to rely on individual journalists, media from neighboring countries, academics, or research organizations. Slowly and gradually, we are getting the information out, with more and more agreements of collaborations being signed. And all in all, there are now more than 75 partners working on this material, and the project is continuing. To this date, only about 15,000 of the 250,000 cables have been released online. This collaboration has been overall very positive and effective, as we are relying on local knowledge, interest, and expertise to give context to the stories. This might be a slow process, but we are a small organization, and we are careful. Overall, we try to take care not to cause unnecessary harm to people, and we have relied on the local in-depth knowledge of our media partners and their evaluation on what needs to be redacted, names and other information that could be harmful. We revise the evaluation of our media partners regularly, and often we have reinstated information that they have decided to omit. Sometimes their evaluation has not met our standard, and they have not been able to explain why they redacted certain things. And there are also cases where a news organization has had to over-redact to protect themselves, for example, from libel lawsuits. I'm not going to dwell on individual important news stories. There are too many to pick from. Overall, it has shown that the priorities are in what the priorities are in the U.S. foreign policy and how it is carried out. Not always in the best of manners. Often dodgy deals are made or even threats. The cables have made diplomatic relationship more transparent. The cables have also brought to light useful information from the host countries, useful and necessary for the people in these countries. It has to be said that the U.S. Embassy staff have been very agile in their information gathering role and have been in a good position to analyze the internal politics and economics rather well in the countries they are operating in. It has been suggested that the cable gate would have a devastating effect on countries' relations. People would no longer be able to have confidential talks based on trust. I believe this is a hyped assumption, and instead we will, and have possibly already seen, a more frank and open dialogue between state leaders. And that is the way it should be. The Middle East provides a good evidence of this. Also last week, the U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates was in Europe meeting partners in NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and it made headlines that he openly and without any sugarcoating harshly criticized the European partners for not pitching enough into the cooperation. And everybody knew that he was referring to the war in Afghanistan. And I wonder if he would have been as blunt openly in a world prior to WikiLeaks. The critics of WikiLeaks have, as before, been quick to denounce the importance of the cable release. This is nothing new, they've said, and tried telling that to the Tunisians. When the Tunisian cable started to surface in early December, they were translated and disseminated to the public in Tunisia. Stories were made on the basis by Al Jazeera and other news organizations. You did not have to tell the Tunisians that Sine El Abidine Ben Ali led a corrupt regime, but the extent of the corruption, with detailed example, was news to many. And maybe most importantly, it was news that the outpost of the State Department knew exactly what kind of a leader Ben Ali was, but still he was supported in Washington as a useful ally. The Tunisians did not like what they read in the embassy cables, and the releases escalated the fury already in place in the country. Mohamed Bouazizi, a young IT graduate who was perhaps very much like an IT graduate from this or any other university, set himself on fire in December last year in protest to the corrupt Tunisian regime, and his tragic death tipped the balance in Tunisia. He died on January 4th, and on January 14th, the Ben Ali family fled the country to Saudi Arabia. And I think it was yesterday or early today that they were charged with 35 years imprisonment, Ben Ali and his wife, and there are more charges to come. That was what was in absentia. And we know that the Tunisian example was an inspiration to the Egyptians, and information in Egyptian cables about internal matters in the country fed the flames. The U.S. thought they could interfere by suggesting that Suleiman would replace President Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, but cables showing that Suleiman had been responsible for the torture chambers in Egypt, which was on occasion in past lent to the United States, did away with that possibility. And the so-called Arab Spring has spread to other countries, as we know, to Bahrain, to Syria, to Yemen, to Libya. Amnesty International has acknowledged the WikiLeaks role as a catalyst in the Arab Spring and dedicated a good part of the introduction in their last annual report to discuss the exciting possibilities of the internet and information leaks. It concluded that last year might be remembered as a watershed year when activists and journalists used new technology to speak truth to power, and in so doing had pushed for greater respect for human rights. I've not mentioned, and talking about the negative effect, if we talk about negative effect to international relations, it has been even acknowledged by Gates, Secretary of Defense, that the effect has primarily been embarrassment. I've not mentioned the release of the Guantanamo files early this spring. The reports on almost all the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay, showing, for example, how appallingly bad information was used as a basis of years of imprisonment without trial. Often information received through torture, leading to children and demented old men being imprisoned. And Guantanamo is surely a black stain on US history. So WikiLeaks has made an impact on our world. It has been a catalyst in the profound changes now happening in the Arab world. The leaks have deepened our understanding of the world we live in. It has excited ordinary people who are losing hope in their government systems and the media. WikiLeaks has shown the traditional media that they were not doing their job properly and needed to make amends after rather a bleak performance in the last decade or two. The idea WikiLeaks represents has sparked the imagination and hope of people who really believe in democracy. They see finally the possibilities of the age of the internet delivering a better life for more people through empowerment on the basis of information dissemination. But how has WikiLeaks changed the world of journalism? Let me give you a few examples. It has challenged the traditional media, and in doing so, and made journalists braver. Our work has reinvigorated journalists the world over to start ask the hard questions again. And this is crucial because a free media is the watchdog of a free society. WikiLeaks has revolutionized the traditional media by partnering with more than 75 traditional newspapers and other media outlets. It has forged a new model for how the media can work together collaboratively, not just in competition for a better reporting in the public interest. WikiLeaks has encouraged the spread of data journalism, sophisticated analysis of large-scale data, such as thousands of war logs, to understand the bigger picture. Same sort of work an intelligence agency does, but the fruits are given to all the people of society and locked in some hidden vault. WikiLeaks has enhanced the spread of new media in more than 20 new leaks sites have sprung up in the wake of WikiLeaks, including IndoLeaks, BalkanLeaks, ThaiLeaks, EnviroLeaks, UniLeaks, and OpenLeaks. And now we even have the Wall Street Journal copying the way WikiLeaks used technology to protect sources, maybe not successfully. They've been criticized for not being very technology secure, easy to trace the material back to the sources, and on the pages you have to basically tick and agree that if there is a legal attack and a quest for the source, they will help out finding the source. So it's quite extraordinary. But even so, Al Jazeera has done the same thing, opening a Dropbox, and that led them to acquire the Palestine papers, and maybe in our tradition of cooperation, the Al Jazeera shared the Palestine papers with the Guardian in England. After practicing journalism for 20 years, I was getting less and less impressed with my profession, I have to admit, but WikiLeaks has given me hope. The idea WikiLeaks represents has made me believe that journalism can again become an element that makes our world a better one. And I believe it was Victor Hugo who said that nothing was as powerful as an idea whose time had come. And I think it should make us feel good to know that there are still ideas to be found who can have a greater impact for good, a greater impact on society than any military misadventure in this world. And let me finally quote an Australian editor who in the mid-50s was defending his paper's right to publish secret documents. And I have this from a trusted journalist here, I hope it's correct. He wrote, "In a race between truth and secrecy, truth will always win." This is very much a WikiLeaks-style quote, And the author of this, of course, is your truly, Rupert Murdoch. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kristen. It's amazing what you can learn about your own society, isn't it? Let me now welcome, or ask you to help me welcome to the microphone, John Cain.
Well, thank you very much, Denison, for that welcome. May I open by saying welcome to you, Kristen, and thank you for coming out here. And congratulations to those who organised it, because despite the ubiquity of the virtual world, there's nothing quite like having the person who knows the game telling you about it face to face. And I can say, tell you, Kristen, that Melbourne from early colonial days was seen as being the place where people with more inquiring and radical minds resided, and nothing's changed. It's still the same. And you'll find that kind of approach in this city more than you will in the northern cities where I think you've been, you're still intending to go. Okay, well now, look, I've been asked to speak to you about freedom of information in the WikiLeaks age, and I suppose in this state and this nation really implicitly. Our legislation in 1982 was arguably, I think, the first attempt in Australia to let citizens know what information governments held about public policy and about the people who resided here, and to do it in an orderly way within the rule of law as perceived at that time. Now is a good time to examine the legislative attempt 30 years ago to lift that curtain to see inside government. As I said, from early days, and how it has fared since. 30 years is a good resting point. 82, 2011. So I welcome the opportunity to do that. In framing the legislation, the government which was elected in April 1982 was conscious, I think, of the opportunity it had in history. And then what I want to do in this paper, and in talking to you tonight, is to examine the First Act and its purposes, to look at the effects and the experience of the use by applicants for access, and the responses and actions of successive governments and agencies over the last 30 years, to look at the changes in public attitudes to disclosure of documents held by government and its agencies and other public bodies, to look at some of the trends in managing the information held by state authorities, such as libraries, which I suppose I should declare an interest, being the president of the State Library Board here in Victoria, and see the principles that have been adopted in those sorts of agencies. And perhaps second lastly, look at how government may respond to this new order and see what the aspiring journalists in this department, in this university, might expect. Look, as a new government with a mandate both general and specific, we were keen to make FOI work and to show the way to other states. Now, that's not to say it was supported across the board. It wasn't, quite the reverse. But I want to say this to you also, after 30 years of the Cold War, and with John Le Carre and James Bond disclosures, we just thought that open and honest government seemed the way to go, and people had a right to expect it after that time. The Cold War wasn't over. I'll say a bit more about that later. But many of the people in our electorate then in 1982 had lived through World War II and its privations, the years of secrecy and government domination. Many citizens had high expectations about what FOI might do for them. I suppose we were a very compliant society for several reasons. I won't go into that now, but we were docile, accepting of government, and I suppose there was no great public clamour for freedom of information. And I suppose we pose the question that Kristen posed today, why the secrecy? It's as if you say to yourself, well, why was that the case? And we believed, looking at the examples overseas, that perhaps it made for better decision-making by an executive government. There was enthusiasm within the new government and perhaps a touch of idealism. Not all our colleagues shared those views. I think the enthusiasts were inspired by what Kristen mentioned before of the Pentagon Papers in the early 1970s and what that had disclosed about governments and what it was saying that governments could do. I think some in the US in those years saw FOI, from the reading that I've done, as almost the enlightenment of the 20th century. They went over the top about it a bit, I think. But we had, as a group of backbench or some backbench members of the Labor Party in Parliament, we'd looked at the other jurisdictions and the models that were there. We had a committee of the party that had talked about it, activists on our Civil Rights and Law Reform Policy Committee. We took it to our conference of the party. So it was, how shall I put it, unlike current political parties' operations, it was a consultative operation within the party. And we'd thought it through and we'd consulted about it. Now, that doesn't happen much these days. I haven't got time to go into that. But we had a draft bill before we won the election in April 82, and it mostly followed the US model. Just a few features of it. We wanted to give the maximum amount of information. We settled after some debate on 45 days for agencies to respond. We had a list of exemptions, as you'd expect. We had a provision for the amendment of personal records, corrections and so on, which is very important. People loved that. And we had a review process. So we claimed in introducing the bill and talking about it that it was beneficial to decision-making, that you need to scrutinise governments and government agencies, that it strengthened the concept of ministerial responsibility, and that it made government more accountable and able better to perform. And government decision-making would be enhanced, we felt, because of the consultation that was involved and the base of decision-making within government and the material relied upon by government, and that's important, was thoroughly examined. Now, they're all the strengths that we saw. And I remember being stopped in the street when just a few days after the bill had been made public by the senior Victorian Supreme Court judge. Nice bloke, and he said to me, look, they were all blokes then too, he said to me, look, this was a big mistake. He said the parliamentary process and the Westminster system provide all the avenues that were necessary for citizens to learn about the government and forget about it. We didn't forget about it, but I think that view did reflect the thinking around a number of other people as well, people in positions of authority and otherwise. Look, if I say this to you, and I think you'll get some responses to this from Canberra, governance is tough. It's a difficult job. And in around government, ministers and some of their advisers and bureaucrats did say to us that FOI, they saw in a negative light. They were not impressed. They urged, or some bureaucrats urged their ministers to oppose the bill in cabinet. They didn't. FOI, I suppose, in a sense, cuts across the way bureaucrats think and want to act. You've got to reckon, and still does. It still does. That they've behaved traditionally in our system of government. They see themselves as being the repositories of information that government needs to function properly. And it should only be revealed on a need-to-know basis. And in their minds, there's very few people need to know. And that's still the case. And it was a vehicle, I put, that was capable of undermining the correctness and the integrity of decisions if people were able to learn what was going on. I should add that when we came to government in 82, there were still some in the bureaucracy who were yet to believe that nepotism and sectarianism was not a bad thing. Or was a bad thing. They believed it was not a bad thing. Only a few. They were still around in 82. Not so now, I don't think. It was It was also argued that FOI heightened the prospect of conflict within government, and that was not a good thing. They said that ministers and agencies would be, if opposing views in agencies could be mounted, it made for some instability. So it was argued a detriment to government unity, that it could cause splits in governments. Look, I think governments are conscious, and we certainly were in 82 and we tackled this, the fact that when information is provided by government to an individual or an organisation, it's not just that person who receives the information. Now, it's available to the whole world. Of course, now they know the capacity for dissemination is total and virtually instant, isn't it? So it's different now than it was then, so far as that issue is concerned. It makes for distrust also, we were told. I'm giving you all the negatives because they were there, and in some instances probably still there. So they talked about the chilling effect that FOI would have on giving frank and fearless advice. You've all heard that. So we'll have to attach little sticky bits of paper on the file that can be taken off at the appropriate time. So I thought it was more about their protecting their territory often, that the power base and their place in the food chain was pretty important. And I think it's the same in any large organisation, public or private, that many large corporations, it's been revealed in recent times, I think some of Kirsten's work in the commercial world has revealed that the relationship between truth and some large corporations is a fairly tenuous one. And I think that's true in large organisations, I think, generally, that they tend to see their own patch as being their turf to protect. Just one counter to all that, as I said to you, the Act had a capacity for people to inspect their own personal records, and they loved that. That was the non-controversial part of the bill, of the Act. They wanted to make corrections, social welfare, all sorts of areas of government activity. So there it was, and the opposition to FOI was considerable. That's what I'm saying to you, essentially. And that's 1982. It's 30 years back now. Have a look at. I want to have a look quickly at the next 30 years. That's to say, 1982 to where we are now. There are many forces at work over that time. I'll necessarily have to be brief because I can't deal with all of the issues that have emerged. But the balance across access and restraint or rejection and secrecy, I think, has ebbed and flowed. As I said, apart from the personal information issue, the most prolific users of FOI in this state, and I think across the country, have been the media and the parliamentary opposition, regardless of which party happens to be in opposition. That's what has happened, and predictable, I suppose. They were early and frequent users. They didn't always have seen FOI as an opportunity to embarrass the government of the day and to get information around government's policy making and implementation processes. But the battle mostly is around the exemptions. Now, those of you who are familiar with the Act, it's in sections 27 capital A and 38 capital A, and mostly that contest, not all, has been around the cabinet documents. That was the sexy part anyway, to get inside cabinet. And that was the mission of a number of journalists, not to mention the opposition, of course, if they could. I said in my second reading speech, and I never resiled from it, that the Act should not allow people inside the cabinet room, that the cabinet oyster was to be protected. That's the word I used, I think. I still am, and I was then and still remain, a very strong advocate of the cabinet system. We in that cabinet, in over 300 meetings in eight and a half years, never had a vote. Everything was by consensus. Now, for that to happen, you must have confidentiality, and you must ensure that there is no open contest inside the cabinet. So getting inside the cabinet, either by documents, working documents, or any other way, can be fatal for a government. The two other areas that have been controversial, and I'll say a bit more about them both, are the commercial in confidence dealings between government and commercial organisations, and terrorism, organised crime with it. Now, I'll link the last two together, I think, because the same sorts of responses have emerged from government. There's public interest tests with some of those exemptions. We don't have time to go into that. Can I say in summary, in looking at the 30 years, successive governments, I think, have proved to be in seeking to hold the line against information being available and in favour of secrecy. There's some of the appeal provisions, of course, in the Act. They've skipped over the quasi-judicial appeal process to conclusive certificates where the head of a department can assert, in the terms of, which I'll mention later, of public policy, that you should proceed or allow the secretary of the department to establish that this can't be released. That's the kind of approach that disclosure would be contrary to public interest, I think, is the term that you find used. It's a term that's used, those of you who are interested in going further, on the in the Patrick Waterside case, where there was a federal court case about release. There'd been a conclusive certificate, and the detail that the head of department was prepared to go to seek to stop the release of those documents is mind-boggling. 10 separate assertions made. Anyway, it's a case worth looking at. 1999 Federal Court. I've got the reference here if anyone wishes it. The other point, I think, or the other area it's worth mentioning is the contracting out of many services of government has been a revelation to most of us, or to me anyway, in the last 30 years. Millions of dollars of public money are in play. Demands by business for exemption are prodigious. I just found it extraordinary that people in this day and age, when government public money is being paid to the private sector to do things, that there should be anyone who would question the need and the desirability of people knowing where that money went and how it went. But that's not the case, I'm afraid, that there are a number of deals with PPPs, government contracting out, that where the exemptions from freedom of information are asserted. And we had the same experience down at Portland, I might add, when the Alcoa company was, when we came to government, had half built the smelter down there. And I suppose to our discredit, we accepted a requirement that they had not to allow freedom of information into certain aspects of the deal, mostly around the establishment or the discovery of Aboriginal middens on the coastal strip there in Portland, that they didn't want work interrupted because of that. And when I look back now, I wonder why we did it. But I suppose the commercial pressures and imperatives are even more intense today than they were then. The fight against terrorism, so-called, and organised crime has led governments, both state and federal, in recent times to diminish accepted civil rights to an alarming degree, in my view. We see summary arrest and detention. We see a denial of people's rights to communicate with family or legal advice, right to silence abridged. That's happening all over the place. And the Commonwealth in 2006, in cooperation with several states, legislated in this direction. They softened it by tacking a 10-year sunset clause onto it. But the device they used is one that has rarely been used. It was a reference of powers from the states to the Commonwealth under Section 5138 of the Constitution. Anyone know what that is? Very rarely has it been done. It was done for ex-nuptial children some time back by two or three states. But all I mention is that it shows the intensity of feeling, populism, tabloid media, urging these kinds of things, that governments were prepared to do it. And the real sting was there was a related provision providing that security-sensitive documents were to be added to documents exempt under FOI. So there's a pattern, it's a network almost of assertions and demands by government to stop people finding out. And again, a conclusive certificate was the device for asserting the need. Look, apart from the battles around exemptions, usage became factors in the way FOI played out. Some of you will be aware of the rising numbers of people in the private office of ministers, both state and federal. Mostly they seem to outnumber the bureaucrats now, but they're a new player. And the private office advisor is seen by many as putting political focus on FOI requests. Now, I don't know whether it's right or not. I'm not there now. But that's the perception that is there. They frequently appear when matters go to the VCAT. They frequently appear in the narratives that are there, and they're somewhere in the food chain. So that's a provocative action by governments, I think, allowing, or ministers allowing that to happen and to be deplored. The delay in meeting requests, it's 45 days, I said, dear, but that's the maximum time to be taken. But many departments make it the minimum as well. Now, it's just arrogant to do it. 45 days, that's working days, it's a fair span of time. And many, many requests can be serviced in far, far fewer days than that. And the practice is that if you're having trouble, if there genuinely is a need for an extension, that's always available. You can go and talk to the applicant, arrange it. It's not going to be the end of the world. So what I'm putting is that to some extent seems to demonstrate the tenacity with which governments are fighting the trends that FOI started. Now, I want to leave FOI and just say to you that while all this has been happening, there's been commentary I suppose it's about FOI, by academics about FOI. It's a constant issue in many newspapers. I've just dug out a few of them. That's the sort of headlines we get. What is it, this one? Anti-terror bill limits FOI. What's that one? The freedom we all need. The newspapers have been vigilant, I have to say, but vigilant mostly in their own interests. They don't follow up much. They'll have a bit of a go on some particular issue, then they drop off. And bills or acts of this kind need constant attention, and you need to keep at it. See, if you get a run for 2 or 3 days in a paper and it's gone, everybody's forgotten about it anyway. So I think what I'm saying is that the academics, of course, claim that the many things about FOI, they're having a good look at it. The Australian Law Reform Commission had a good look at it. Tabloid and broadsheets are all in it. So there's constant claims and assertions about it, but there's not the will to follow up most times. Now, there may be many reasons for that, but there's no organised group outside, although the media should be organised, but they're mostly organised and fighting each other. But there's no organised group to take on the needs of this kind for amendment. So can I just summarise what I see as the current state of play in FOI at the moment? The last 30 years have seen a continuing fight with ebbs and flows, as I said, between governments, agencies and often business on the one hand, and the media and opposition, various interest groups on the other, about where the line should be drawn. The increasing involvement, as I say, of government in the commercial sector has led to increasing use of that exemption. On balance, though, I'm told by, how shall I put it, with discretion, a number of people in the public sector that while the contest has flowed, that on balance, the maintenance of secrecy in governments is in front. They reckon 30 years down the track, they've held the line and then a bit. Now, they claim, and I can't judge this, they claim that the widening of the cabinet document definition is the main reason for that. And I suspect that's probably right. So that's a rough, quick journey down the 30-year path. It was introduced into our society, as I say, with, I think, few expectations about knowing what went inside, what people might get from it, and I think all that has changed. Now, what I want to say to you now is that since 1982, in these last 30 years, I think other things have changed outside FOI. Better educated society, an internet calling into question, as you've heard tonight with great eloquence, government and and social policy around it. See, I think in the last 5 years, it can confidently be said that governments have lost control of protection of privacy and personal information. I think they have, pretty well. Some volunteers have helped out with their tweeting and their tweeting. They've lost control of gambling in most forms. Constitutional difficulties have something to do with that, but they've lost that as well. Mostly around pornography, except where young children are involved, where the tabloid newspapers worry them a bit. So I think people are starting to ask is how far should nation states go in seeking to control these things? Can they keep up with the hackers? Can they? Should they try? Now, I think all those questions are in play now, and our federal systems, I say, enables other difficulties to be put into place in front of government. It was only last week I was over the road at another part of this campus and this university in discussion with a number of university academics. They claim that the commitment of students to the social cyber network, I'll call it, is unstoppable. I don't know if any of you know here got a view on it, but I cross-examine them about it. They say they'll pull out the electronic device anywhere, lectures, tutorials, just talking to you in the corridor. Just, they can't control it. So they're saying that, I don't know whether that's right or not, but they're saying that it comes before anything else in their lives. RSI of the thumb, one person put it, that's what they're getting. And if that's the case, I think it's only a short step for those students to be demanding instant communication, not just with their own social set and who's with whom, but as to what's held by government. It's a very short step. And in a truly global economy, which we're told we have now, with a more aggressive commercial component, who can say where it'll all finish? Now, I want to make a mention now of libraries. I told you of my interest, but libraries, as you all know, I'm sure, hold millions of items in a diverse range of increasingly electronic publishing format. They've committed, and I quote here, to free and equal access to information. That's the Australian Library and Information Association, ALIA. And they say this, and I quote, "Public sector information is defined as information created by parliamentary and government agencies, by Commonwealth and state and local government agencies, directories such as the Government Directory, and research commissioned by government agencies such as the Australian Research Council." ALIA says people engaged in library and information services are members of a profession committed to intellectual freedom and the free flow of ideas and information. Now, the range of information is just extraordinary, and the access to it is extraordinary. Are you aware that the US Library of Congress has achieved, every public tweet of putting on their site, every public tweet or Twitter since 2006. And they've been collecting materials from the web since it began, harvesting congressional and presidential campaign websites from 2000. Today, the Library of Congress holds more than 167 terabytes, is that right? Of web-based information, including legal blogs, websites for candidates for national office, and websites of members of Congress. Now, we're not that good at the State Library, but we've got a fairly good run there too. I just want to mention one thing. After those bushfires, we responded very quickly following those bushfires and provided copies of the Royal Commission online. These were immediately and heavily accessed. So what I'm saying is, whether we like it or not, it's on. It's on. You know, people are now living in a world where they expect and believe they have an entitlement to everything that's known and unknown. That's their expectation. And it's a very different society to the one we addressed, which was heavily racist. We're getting out of racism in 1982. It's just starting. We had no ideas about equal opportunity. Females had to be, they were there. But the equal opportunity in the public sector in the 80s really had to be realised before equal opportunity, and in the private sector as well. So it's still emerging. It's a very different scene to what we have now. And I think, and I'm asked to say, where's this how do we judge this now? I think governments will go on doing what they've been doing since 82, but with increasing fail rates, I suspect. They'll endeavour to hold back the long-term trend. They won't succeed because people are different now than they were. The long-term sweep of history will see those forces that are around a better educated society wanting to be informed about particular issues, and the impact of that social media and the immense capacity for information dissemination. Our libraries, our government agency, enormous capacity. So the citizen will gain more ground, I think. That's the way I see it. And I put it in my lifetime span. I think I've seen a number of issues. Sectarianism, I suppose, the one that I see as being vicious in my childhood, as was racism. We still perform very badly with our Aboriginal people, but the trend has been better all the way through. What I'm saying is, on issues that take a long time to resolve, don't be frightened, don't be too disappointed when you get setback, because you will. That's inevitably what happens in long-term policy planning. We move to better things on the sweep of history, but there are blockages on the way. There are forces at work that I mentioned, I think, are building. WikiLeaks is just the latest addition. It'll be part of that media picture, that capacity for communication picture that we have. What about those students of journalism that you've got here, Dennis? I think that they've got to realise that's the world they're going to be in. Curb it by saying to yourself, there's a lot of rubbish out there on the web, there is, and you've got to, we have a filter at the library where people can, school children can check out with people on the phone, real people, certain items they see. So recognise that, but there's no substitute for the thoroughness of being able to do that kind of research yourself and satisfy yourself with the maximum information available. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you very much, John. We've got time for some questions, I think, about 10 minutes. Be right. From five. So we have some microphones here. If you wish to ask a question, please put up your hand, wait for the microphone, tell us who you are, ask a question. Over there.
Hi, my name is Luke, and I'm a PhD student here, so thank you very much, both of you, for the talk, and I'll ask three questions, if I may. The first, just what we heard about cabinet, keeping cabinet secret, sorry, and I saw you scribbling notes of possibly, you know, why do we need to keep cabinet secret? Parliament wasn't reported on before, let's move that to cabinet. My first question is, do you think transparency can ever catch up? If we open up cabinet for secrecy, will those conversations be moved somewhere else that is secret? Will transparency ever be able to catch up? My second question is, Kristen, when you started the conversation with us, you said, you know, thank you to all the bloggers and tweeters out there in the audience, and we think you're a big part of this new space of journalism. When we look at kind of the evolution that WikiLeaks has had, starting with a wiki that was very inclusive and maybe moving to more a PR-based thing where we're putting out little stories in 2000, PR snippets in 2007 to an editorial-based thing for Collateral Murder to collaboration with the mainstream media. In the next chapter of whatever WikiLeaks turns into, what part will those bloggers, those tweeters, that crowd that you know was envisioned in the start have? And I'll stop it.
Okay, thanks. That's good. Well, let's have John answer the first question and Kristen answer the second.
Well, I don't think cabinet secrecy will change, nor should it. I support on the basis not just of good decision-making surroundings or the ability for good decision-making. I don't regard myself, nor do I regard any of my colleagues in Cabinet, as being the repository of all wisdom. The collective decision-making of 18 people around the table, we had 18, is a very, very sound way. You get all points of view, you get a consensus approach, and you are the beneficiary of advice and counsel from your colleagues about things which you didn't know. So I hope it doesn't. 27 in a cabinet can be too many, which is what other federal cabinets have had. The number needs to be examined. But it's a very good sounding board. We had an item in cabinet on every agenda, which was what we call current political issues. But they were just what was happening in the society around you. And it was a very, very good way of being politically aware. The contribution of 18 people or however many contributed is an important ingredient in that sort of process. So don't rubbish the cabinet oyster. It's proved a very, very sound process of decision making, not just in Westminster countries but elsewhere.
Christian, you want to
I think it's interesting what you said about cabinet secrecy, if I may add to that a little bit. I think we should take the next step forward and have cabinet meeting totally in the open. Let me give you an example of what is happening in my own country. We are rewriting the constitution because it was part of the failure in the society there that the constitution wasn't protecting. It wasn't a social contract that worked. It is being rewritten by a constitutional assembly. Every discussion is in the open. It's on the web. It's televised on the web. And the people are asked to involve directly by Facebook, by Twitter. So it is basically crowdsourcing. So the input is there. It's a fascinating experience. Everything is out in the open. There's disagreement there, and people disagree within the assembly. So why not on the cabinet level? To your question with the method that we have used and where we are going, I think that we will. It depends a bit on the material that we are working on. The method we used in getting out to the public was in relation to the nature of it. Prior to April last year, WikiLeaks was doing a journalistic job on the material. The analysis was within the organization. And the verification of the authenticity of the material, then it was released with a report on the web. So it was pretty much what every media organization is doing. You talk about editorialization of the Apache attack video. I've been a broadcasted journalist for a very long time, and whenever anybody speaks about heavy editing there, you know, they've seen nothing of heavy editing. You know, it's basically a short, small section of putting it in context, and then I think 12 minutes of unedited footage. And we provided the fully unedited 40 minutes plus on the web at the same time, so everybody could go and if he distrusted the presentation or the editing, he could see it in the context of the raw material. And then again, the sheer amount of information in the Afghan warlocks and the Iraq warlocks and the cables is such that we needed to take a step towards the media, the conventional media. We did a bit of wrestling there in getting them to work in a new and different manner. I think it is truly historical that we achieved to get so many journalists together working on such a project, and actually without the roof exploding, you know, they're not used to that kind of collaboration. So the question to the future, it will be in relation to the nature of the material that we will release.
Can I just say on the cabinet issue again that I think the cabinet in the open, that's the consultative process. That's when you find out what people want, what their views are. The decision-making process is when the government accepts collective responsibility. It's a government decision, not a minister, not a single individual. It's a government decision, and has the our rules, our conventions, has the support of every member of the government. It's the government makes the decision.
Thanks, John. Any other questions? Yes, there.
Yeah, hey, this question is for Kristen.
Would you mind standing up and telling us who
sure.
you are?
This question is for Kristen. There was this thing that was dubbed the insurance file, which was published as well by the WikiLeaks sort of project. And I guess, could you please explain the background behind that to the people who don't know? And also what went into the decision-making process to publish that? I think it was, to me, a landmark in the history of journalism because I think it appeared to be the first time sort of advanced cryptography had actually been used in the publication process and was also highly unorthodox. And I suppose, was it a product of fear? Was it a... yes, what was the decision process behind the publication of that?
Okay, thank you.
Well, the you have to go back to the atmosphere that was we were facing last summer. There was a real threat. Oh, the insurance file. It is a large file that was put on the web, encrypted, and with a message that if the organization would be taken down and the individuals working for organization would be arrested or having, you know, even killed, that would be released the key to the information. So it would be available to everybody. Some took it as a threat. We saw it as an insurance, basically making sure that the material would be out there among the public. We were under such severe threat at the time, and I mentioned Sarah Palin here. She was not the only one calling for the hunting and assassination of Julian and others within WikiLeaks. It was basically a hysteria going on at the time. So we had, at that time, a natural concern, I think, about the safety of the people and their security.
Other questions? Well, I think I'll take the opportunity to thank you all for coming, and in particular to thank our two guest speakers for a most stimulating presentation. Thank you.